Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Migration Policy Institute. I'm Dimitri Papadimitriou, and I would like to welcome all of you who are here in person, but also those who are at home viewing this event, because the event is being streamlined. It is... No, it's streaming.
Live streamed.
That's right. I have to read these things. Okay, so we're back in the ice. That's very good. So it is a distinct pleasure to welcome to the Migration Policy Institute a good friend of the Institute and personal friend, Mexico's ambassador to the United States, Eduardo Medina Mora. Now, as many of you know, there have been an awful lot of high-level people that have sat in this podium, have spoken elegantly and in depth about issues, but I can not think of anyone who could possibly be better prepared to address these issues than the ambassador can. He has held senior positions in the last three governments, and we know how difficult it is to do that in any government. He has been Attorney General of Mexico. He's been Secretary of Public Security. These are cabinet appointments in Mexico. He has been the head of the agency CISEN. It's sort of the joint FBI analytical intelligence agency of Mexico. Most recently, he was ambassador to the UK from 2009 to 2012. And now, thankfully, he is the ambassador to the United States. The topic of today's conversation is something that can be addressed most eloquently and definitively by the ambassador. The format of today's event will be sort of a conversation. We'll start with the ambassador making a few remarks, then Doris, both responding to some of the topics that the ambassador puts on the table, but also going beyond that to address issues of borders, etc. And then we'll have a conversation, both between the two speakers, but also between you, the audience, our friends, and the speakers, and I'll try to sort of moderate this. So without further ado, I'd like to turn the floor over to you, Eduardo.
Thank you very much. Extremely honored to be here today. First of all, because Migration Policy Institute is in the center of understanding issues that are complex in nature and normally misunderstood. A few years back, when I was visiting DOD, I met with assistant secretary who was in charge of intelligence. And he told me something that stayed with me since then. This was 2002. And he told me, Eduardo, you have to understand something. Reality is classified. and it is. Because we drive our understanding of issues from perceptions, emotions, few facts, and then we combine them, and they evolve with circumstance together with us. But really, to understand an issue such complex as migration, I think that we are in the right venue, and I am very lucky and happy to be sharing this event with Dimitri Papadimitriou and Doris Meissner, two close friends, and I would say mentors in this area. Of course, the challenge that Dimitri has put ahead of me is I have to speak elegantly, in depth, and eloquently about something which is quite complex, but I will just try to convey some facts and interpretations on what is going on in Mexico, and then what we can make out of this and what has to do with migration. And of course, the relationship between Mexico and the U.S. is as complex as it can get and intense. And of course, migration is a never-changing phenomenon. But the pace of this change has been much faster the last 20 years. In this time span, we have witnessed an exponential growth of Mexican immigration to this country in the 90s, and a significant slowdown that reached almost balance net, zero balance net, they say. It is impossible to say that because no one is really counting people in and out the stadium. But as a trend, you can actually almost safely claim that we are close to a balance in 2010 and on. And this is, of course, according to the Pew Hispanic Center, but this is obvious from the figures. In this presentation, I would like to share some thoughts about the recent transformation of Mexico and its bilateral relationship with the U.S. I will place special emphasis on four ideas: structural changes, the health of Mexico's economy, our shared border, and the contributions of Mexicans to this country. At a time when immigration reform has gained momentum, and some regard it as a unique window of opportunity within a series of fortunate coincidences, we must remember that the United States and its people have long worked for this opportunity, and that chance has played a minor role. Similarly, it's not serendipitous that Mexico is now doing much better, both economically and socially. We have made great strides in order to reach this point and work closely with the U.S. in order to anchor some of our achievements. I believe that now is the time to cash in the hard work as individual countries and, of course, as a region. We are strong and competitive looking forward because we share this economic space and we are, in that sense, competitive together. Today, Mexico is once again on the move. What happens in streets and factories across the country is quite different from what some foreign observers might assume. Mexico is on a sustained path of progress. Challenges remain very much visible, of course, but we work every day to overcome them. In the first 130 days of President Peña Nieto's trade, the main political parties signed a historic, wide-ranging, and forward-looking political agreement under which Congress passed two major structural reforms and is already considering a third. See changing proposals to reform the telecommunications sector. We already did labor and education. Of course, we have to implement them, but the constitutional step has been taken, and that is the most challenging part of that politically. The Washington Post and the New York Times, among others, have highlighted the consensus-building model that has overcome years of gridlock in Mexican Congress. We have to remember that Mexico has not had a majority in Congress since 1997. So actually, to get things through Congress has been difficult. So this is not a minor achievement for the Mexican political actors, not only for, of course, the president who has been leading this effort. Our economy is expanding. We have maintained 14 consecutive quarters of growth since the 2009 global downturn. GDP per capita in Mexico has increased nominally from $7,852 in 2009 to $1,047 in 2011 in current dollars. In purchasing power, it is over $15,000. And our GDP growth for 2012 was 3.9, a higher rate than the average of the 20 years prior, and it's expected to grow 3.5%. This year, our country risk, as measured by J.P. Morgan's Emerging Market Bond Index, has long been lower than Brazil's and Argentina's. Mexico is taking care of its people and businesses. We have become predominantly a middle-class country. The Brookings Institution has highlighted that 60% of Mexico's population is middle class today. And by 2030, 86.5% of all Mexicans will have a middle class status. There has been a tripling since 1980 in the number of Mexican students to receive higher education, and housing credit credit has increased more than 24 since the early 70s. All of these factors reduce the immigration pressure of the past. As I mentioned before, academics and nonpartisan think tanks now estimate that the net migration between Mexico and the U.S. is balanced or close to zero for the first time in decades. A recent Gallup survey shows that only 11% of Mexicans say they would leave the country if given the opportunity, a decline of about half from what was said so in 2007. As a reference, 11% of Americans also told Gallup that they would consider moving to another country. So this is very much, I would say, balanced mood. Our region, our shared economic space, is a region of opportunity. North America is and should remain a region of opportunities for all. Under the North American Free Trade Agreement, bilateral trade and investment within the region have grown exponentially. In 2012 alone, Mexico-U.S. total trade almost reached $500 billion, more than $1.3 billion a day cross that border on a daily basis, almost $1 million per minute. Mexico is the third largest U.S. trading partner. But the Mexican market is fundamental to the U.S. economy. In 2012, U.S. exports to Mexico totaled $216 billion. This is more than the $210 billion of combined U.S. exports to all the countries with which it has trade agreements in place, excluding Canada, of course. It is more than U.S. exports to Japan and China combined, $180 billion. It is larger than the sum of the exports to France, Germany, the Netherlands, and the United Kingdom, $175 billion. And if you keep on building examples of Taiwan, Korea, Singapore, Malaysia, and Thailand combined, well, you sell more products to Mexico than to all of those countries combined. So in this sense, exports to Mexico maintain and create jobs in the United States. The U.S. government estimates that each additional billion of new exports supports more than 6,000 jobs. Exports to Mexico increased $18 billion in 2012, thus potentially helping create over 107,000 new jobs in the U.S. Almost 6 million U.S. jobs rely on trade with Mexico, according to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The United States benefit from exports to Mexico. Mexico has been the largest destination for exports of three U.S. states. Of course, those who are closer to us geographically, Arizona, California, and Texas. And the second destination for exports from 20 states. And was ranked one of the top five export destinations for 34 states. 17 states send more than 10% of their exports to Mexico. So in the equation, Mexico matters a lot in terms of exports and job creation. And it is important to understand that 95% of world consumers do not live in America. So this is important. Mexico and the U.S., we together compete in the global economy. Production and supply chains in North America are deeply integrated and successfully integrated, I would add. The U.S. content of Mexican exports to the U.S. is estimated at around 40%. As a reference, it stands about 25% for Canadian exports and 4% for China's, only 2% for European Union. So whenever a U.S. consumer buys a product which is manufactured in China, in that product only 4% of the value is American. And when a product is bought and it's manufactured from Mexico, 40% of the value is American. So this is because components and systems go back and forth the border very effectively before a consumer can identify a product as something they can buy. And, well, this has been the outcome of this successful economic integration, particularly in manufacturing and services. investment flows are mutually beneficial. According to data compiled by USTR, sales of services in Mexico by majority U.S.-owned affiliates were $35 billion in 2012. Sales of services in the United States by majority Mexico-owned firms were almost $5 billion in the same year. Our border. This is an area of problems, of course, but also an area of prosperity and competitiveness. Over the last few years, our common border has increasingly become an area of prosperity and regional competitiveness. It is more dynamic and more secure than it has ever been. Together, the 10 border states, 4 in the United States, 6 in Mexico, have 13 million inhabitants residing across each other, and together would constitute the world's fourth largest economy. Mexico and the United States continue to work closely together on a day-to-day basis. Much remains to be done, but our country's progress can be objectively measured. Bilateral cooperation is stronger than ever in areas such as infrastructure development, security, and trade facilitation. I will share two examples to illustrate this new closer collaboration. The U.S.-Mexico 21st Century Border Management Declaration, which was signed in May 2010, gave the two countries the opportunity to give a long-recognized increasing importance of building a prosperous border that thrives and contributes to the welfare of communities in both countries, sharing the objective of promoting greater economic competitiveness and security. The two governments work together through an executive steering committee, by the way, meeting this week in Washington, that regularly monitors and ensures the implementation of specific actions to facilitate the movement of goods and people in a safe, efficient, expeditious, and lawful manner. More bridges, more trade. The border between Mexico and the U.S. is one of the busiest in the world, with 53 ports of entry and 32 international bridges. As I said, around $1.4 billion is traded every day. 300,000 vehicles crosses on a daily basis take place, including 70,000 trailers. Over 1.1 million people crossing the border on a daily basis legally. The new border crossings are in operations as of 2012, two between the states of Texas and Tamaulipas, and one between Arizona and Sonora in the coming months. The first new railway crossing in over 100 years will start operations. Amazing, since the Mexican Revolution, this is the first. Additionally, the crossings between Boquillas and Carmen Big Bend National Parks has just begun operations. Mexicans in the United States have an important contribution to this country. As they traditionally have, Mexicans in the United States make great contribution to the economy and social fabric of the communities they live in. The work ethic they display is broadly recognized by the private sector and civil society. Many are also entrepreneurs, and even during challenging economic times, they have continued to create jobs in the U.S. Mexicans do make significant contributions to the U.S. economy. I was just reviewing this morning a story by Banco Bilbao Vizcaya Foundation, which states that first-generation Mexicans contributed with about 4.1% of the U.S. GDP in 2007. Following the effects of the crisis, the contribution of Mexican immigrants fell to 3.8% in 2009. However, if second- and third-generation Mexicans are added, their contribution to GDP is closer to 8%. Mexicans make local economies grow faster. This is obvious for those who live in communities in which Mexicans make a large or relatively visible proportion of the population. But most Mexicans live, it's obvious, in California. 37% of Mexican-born citizens, 4.3 million, live in California. And in Texas, 21% of Mexican-born citizens living in this country, 2.5 million, live in Texas. States that grew above the national average economically. According to this institute, so to the Bible, the cities with more Mexican immigrants are L.A., 15%, 1.7 million. We tend to joke in Mexico that LA is the second largest city of Mexico. Chicago 6%, 684,000, and Dallas 5%, 610,000 people. And the economies of these cities grew faster than the national average. Our government, through our 50 consulates, remain committed to assisting them in their efforts to achieve greater personal development and to support their engagement with their communities. Just a brief note as a conclusion. Our two countries need to build on the positive dynamics now in place. Our partnership has proven to have a strong positive impact in our societies. A new era of opportunities stands before us. If we seize them together, then together we will continue to thrive. The current discussion of comprehensive immigration reforms opens new possibilities to strengthen this great country, the U.S., and the region, us as a whole. We will closely and respectfully follow this debate. We can make, of course, contributions whenever it's needed to make sure that our top priority, increasing the opportunities and the well-being of our nationals, is advanced on both sides of the border, regardless of the final outcomes of the process. On May 2-3, President Barack Obama will visit Mexico. This will be an opportunity to relaunch the bilateral relationship and will set the tone for the coming 4 years. It will also prove crucial to harness the deep and energy of our partnership moving forward in the decades to come. Thank you very much, Lady Doris, for having me here, and certainly I look forward to comments, questions, and of course discussion with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. It always helps being reminded, because we often forget it, particularly in this city, how large the contributions of Mexico and Mexicans are to the U.S. economy. And I think being reminded is, you know, sort of a bit cathartic. We also typically forget how much progress is being made every day on the ground in terms of the relationship, both the economic relationship, the broader relationship, and the security relationship between our two nations. So I am glad that you're the person who reminded us of all these things. Doris.
Okay, well...
I'm assuming that Doris does not need an introduction. Okay,
please.
So.
It's wonderful to hear you go through these things, Mr. Ambassador, and as you say and as Dimitri said, we've known each other in the past, but I think this is our first public effort together, and so I want to officially welcome you, officially welcome you, and officially congratulate you. And we obviously look forward to continuing to work together now in this capacity, particularly with the time that we're in and what is coming up, which is going to be a very, I think you used the word earlier, lively, if nothing else, period in the coming months. But thinking about this session and thinking about what it is that you've talked about and the framing that you have of the change over the past 20 years makes me go back in my own thinking as well, and I want to tap into a little bit of my own experience from a U.S. perspective in commenting from a U.S. perspective on the outline that you have sketched for us. Because much of the U.S.-Mexico relationship and much of what is in discussion today in the immigration debate does go back 20 years and does go back to a time in the early to mid-1990s when the border and issues of border enforcement and control of the borders, I think, first became a truly national concern. Obviously, they've always been there, and people in the border regions and so on have dealt with these issues for, you know, decades and centuries. But as a national issue and a national political issue, that period in the early 1990s was one where, particularly in California, there was a ballot initiative known as Proposition 187 that became really a microcosm of a national debate. There was a gubernatorial re-election, Governor Wilson was running for office and really staked his campaign on issues of immigration control and the border. And there was a period of time where many states in the Southwest were suing the federal government. They were suits, really, that were political suits. They didn't really have serious legal issues, but they were a way of signaling that there was just a frustration and a sense that the federal government had simply abdicated its responsibilities and was not dealing effectively with the border and with border enforcement. So borders and the Southwest border with Mexico became a national political issue early in the Clinton administration. And the question then in the Clinton administration was, well, what do you do about it? And the answer was, you build up the resources. And so quickly, really within the first year of the Clinton administration, a real change happened on the budget front with taking and looking at resources as the way to get a hold of the issue of the Southwest border and lean forward in responding to the criticisms and to the concerns that were coming from the region. Now, that resource buildup and that approach was consistent with the thinking in the administration at that time, President Clinton as a Democrat, as a centrist. The Democratic centrists that really became then the dominant view in the Democratic Party were ones that looked at the law and order issue and at the issue of enforcement and anti-crime measures as a way of having a different face on the party and on the party's concerns. And immigration and immigration enforcement was a subset of that broader philosophy. It also was, from the point of view of immigration and the evolution of immigration policy over the years, a belated response to IRCA and the IRCA three-legged stool idea of border enforcement, employer enforcement, and legalization. But the border enforcement really didn't kick in until this resource buildup began in the 1990s to make border enforcement be more real and more robust. So those resource infusions in the 1990s, I think we can see in retrospect, really were the official starting point of a story that we've lived with ever since and that continues today and is alive and well in the current CIR debate. It's a commitment on the resource front and on the importance of border enforcement that has been shared by both parties in leadership, both of the executive branch, the presidency, as well as leadership in the Congress. And as I say, it's still on the table, and it's going to be part of what it is that we're talking about when an immigration reform bill is introduced, presumably in the coming weeks. If you look at what that resource buildup actually then translated into operationally on the ground, I would say that we were operating along the lines of about six principles in putting those resources to use. And each one of those principles has quite a story and quite a set of issues involved with it, but I want to tick through them just very quickly as top-line items because of where it is that Mexico comes into the picture. The first principle had to do with the overall idea of deterrence through prevention, and that was the idea that resources should be put up front, as close to the border as possible, to prevent people from coming into the country rather than waiting till they arrived and then tried to chase them down. The second principle was concentrating resources, and the concentrating of resources took the form of investing in what were then the four heavy crossing corridors, San Diego, El Paso, Nogales, McAllen. That, of course, began with Gatekeeper in San Diego and then Hold the Line in El Paso. But that idea of concentrating resources was quite different from what had been done before, which was basically an even sprinkling around. The third big principle had to do with the proper mixture of resources. I mean, historically, resources to the border had basically been in the form of staffing, Border Patrol agents, but the argument that we made with this new build-up was that you needed to have a mixture of people, equipment, and technology. Now it's called people, infrastructure, and technology. And that, of course, had to do with lots of different changes. I mean, it had to do with support staff. It had to do with building fencing. It had to do with installing lighting, creating roads for access to the border. It also had to do with heavy infusions of technology, and one of them that has become so well known since is IDENT. I mean, IDENT was originally introduced as part of the border buildup in the 1990s. But then the next three of the principles all involved Mexico in rather direct and new ways. The fourth principle basically was active engagement and coordination with Mexico. It was built on the idea that the border was a two-way proposition, that you couldn't simply do this all as a unilateral matter, even though that's where the resources were being, that's how the resources were flowing to the border. And so the idea of close coordination and communication with Mexican officials operationally at the ground level, law enforcement professionals across the border for the purposes of not only communication but solving problems as quickly as they arose where it is that they were happening. So it was really pushing responsibility down and creating the relationships at the operational level among professionals that was extremely important. And the effort was to have no surprises. I mean, a basic rule of any kind of good relationships, whatever the news is, tell it and address it rather than let things spin out of control. And so we created what were called the border liaison mechanisms, which were efforts in every sector to meet on a regular basis across the border with all the officials involved in one way or another. And some of them were very sprawling groups because there are lots of different players on both sides. But it was all for the purposes of building trust, raising issues, working out procedures, etc. We mandated advisory committees to every sector with community stakeholders of all sorts, which always involved the consuls, the Mexican consuls, in those sectors. We worked very closely together, Mexico and the United States, to expand Mexico's consular networks in the United States, not only at the border but throughout the country, in order to deal with the issues of protection. So that engagement took lots of different forms, but it was a relatively new, explicit feature of the border resource buildup. The fifth principle, I think, was the idea that we call borders that work, and that was that the borders had to be places that both prevented illegal activity but also facilitated legal crossings and legal activity. And so that involved our ports of entry and the 20-minute rule to come across so that trade would not be impeded. It involved creating the first sentry lanes, which not only needed statutory change in the United States, but involved Mexico in that physical modifications had to be made on roads that were in Mexican territory. So the facilitation part of borders and borders that were really a living element of our economies and our well-being as countries was the fifth principle. And then I think that the final sixth principle was the growing awareness of border safety and the responsibilities that we both had as countries where border safety issues were concerned. Particularly difficult topic when you're dealing with illegal crossing and the kind of migration dynamics and relationship that we have had. But we did make border safety an explicit part of the Border Patrol mission. It had always been something that Border Patrol agents had been involved in, but it now became an explicit part of the mission. And we worked on very delicate, difficult issues with Mexico, such as deaths at the border, where we established accountability on both sides, but we matched our numbers on a regular basis. We made it a responsibility to track what it is that happened. And Mexico and the United States worked together to find the families, whether they were in the United States or in Mexico, of those people who had perished. These were all new initiatives which hadn't been done in the past. So when you look back on all of that from today's vantage point, what it really adds up to over time is a 20-year history, as you said as well, where the United States and Mexico have worked together with varying degrees of success. There have been ups and downs when people have changed and when priorities and administrations have changed, etc. But by and large, it's been a growing, deepening relationship where law enforcement has become a means, even under more difficult, broader policy differences and dysfunctions, where law enforcement cooperation has been a means of knowing what and how to function binationally on a key element of the relationship. Now that, I think, was also driven by the larger imperative here that is important and I think important to call out, and that is the passage of NAFTA in 1993. Because really, at the end of the day, the ultimate premise, I believe, underlying NAFTA is that the futures of Mexico, the United States, and Canada are bound together. And so if your futures are bound together, you are simply required to function in professional, pragmatic, problem-solving ways on particular issues, which is what these law enforcement issues at the border, I think, ultimately represented. NAFTA also was, at that time, and I think still needs to be seen, as the longer-term answer to the issues of illegal immigration, on a parallel track, but obviously with a very longer-term trajectory as compared to the day-to-day sorts of things that we had to deal with every morning when the store opened. But the analytics on Mexico that surrounded the NAFTA debate were analytics that showed that Mexico would turn a corner structurally by about 2014-15. And those structural points were the issues of the demographics and the economy, etc. And it's so interesting because we advanced those ideas in the NAFTA debate, and those of us that were charged with making a case to particular Congress people that were concerned about the immigration implications of NAFTA made those points, and we certainly believed those points, but it's very, very different now in retrospect to look back and see that, in fact, they largely have happened. And not only have they largely happened, as you've described, they're ahead of schedule. So that really lets us go fast forward to where we are today and to the tour d'horizon that you've given us. Because the question that we have to confront and that I want to close with is, why is this important? Why is this so important beyond simply being of interest from the U.S. perspective and from what is going on in the U.S. today? Well, it's important for a couple of reasons. The first is that it's happening as part of a convergence of very critical changes. One of the critical changes, obviously, in the U.S. has been the recession, changes in the migration dynamics between our countries. One of the points, obviously, is the U.S. recession, the fall off in jobs, that has taken place, but the fact that the recovery as it's happening and as it's likely to happen is not going to create a status quo ante situation. It's going to be a different kind of an economy than the one that we had leading up to 2010, which was so heavily driven by a huge demand and appetite for low-skill, low-wage labor. So you then have the changes in Mexico that you've described, which are structural changes. They are not simply 1 year and then we go on to something else. These are fundamental structural changes, and that's critically important. And then finally, the convergence here does involve what I've been talking about on the border, with border enforcement and immigration enforcement in general having become a modern, well-resourced, also here-to-stay capability in the United States, some of that very much a function of the post-9/11 era, but also where the border and the U.S.-Mexico relationship is concerned, dating back to these things that began in the 1990s. Now, that enforcement, of course, is a potent factor. It's part of the mix. But one thing about it that I think bears noting here is what's happened in the Border Patrol and CBP's thinking itself going forward. And that is that they've published a new strategic plan, which I like to say hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but I try to give it attention, because it's very significant. It's a significant shift. Its new strategic plan, which is a four-year strategic plan, 2012 to 2016, says that that there is now a shift at the southwest border, and it's a shift from resource building, the kind of resource building that I described having begun in the 1990s, to a risk-based approach. And that shift to a risk-based approach in southwest border enforcement basically says we're at a steady state. We're where we need to be on resources. The question now is how we use those resources, how nimble we can be with them, how quickly we're able to respond, and what is the changing nature of the risks, and how do we align the resources with those risks. And in the process of describing what that means to them, their call is for deeply increasing partnerships across the law enforcement world, but particularly with deepening the coordination and cooperation with Mexico. So these are all big changes, and they're changes at, you know, varying levels, but they are significantly lasting, here to stay, as I say, and they have converged. So we're at a point in time that is an extraordinarily important and different point in time. Well, that means a lot for what's going on now in the debate in the United States, because the biggest stone in the road now with the migration relationship is the overall perversity of it. We've basically done, I think, what can be done in workarounds to this big macro problem that we have not solved. And so hopefully we are on the path now, I don't want to say path, we are hopefully now in a process of dealing with that broken system. It is ours in the United States to take the responsibility of fixing that. It's not fitting, it's not wise for Mexico to be a player in all of that. But the Mexican story, as the ambassador has told it here, is essential as a new reality, as a changing assumption that needs to be known and that should make us be hopeful that comprehensive immigration reform can happen and succeed in a way that IRCA was not able to succeed. There's reason to have real confidence that was not possible even 6 years ago in the last debate, that neither a legalization measure or a viable future flows measure would turn into a new magnet for new flows that basically sabotage the legislation that would be enacted. So what we're talking about here today, what it is that the ambassador has described, is really an essential message. And it's an essential understanding that needs to inform the debate that is taking place and will be continuing in the United States. I think at the broader level, it's also important to say that this new understanding and this change that we see in Mexico is a new platform for building the next phases of what has been and will continue to be a very long-term project in North America, among our three countries and in this region. And that is that North America, where Mexico, the United States, and Canada become more similar than different in the prosperity and well-being that's available to all of our citizens. Also, a region where borders are managed to protect our nations, but are also effectively facilitating trade and travel to the well-being of our three nations, and a region where migration is a choice, not a necessity. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Doris, for not only talking with us about the underpinnings of the always evolving relationship between the United States and Mexico, and a relationship, incidentally, that is growing stronger all the time, and has created a moment now in 2013 which both of the comments from the ambassador and from Doris, and you know, you implied this, so you may have used the word, is a moment of opportunity. Because essentially what we have seen is an awful lot of continuity while at the same time an awful lot of change. So what it is that, you know, and what people, of course, who always take either the half-empty or half-full kind of approach to all of this, you can focus on all of the things that still go crack or bang in the night, or you can focus, I think, on the secular trend, which is one of a stronger relationship, a more cooperative relationship, a growing, dramatically growing economic relationship, and a convergence, as Doris called it, or a convergence of opportunities between the two countries that I think is the result of the confluence of a lot of forces and events, all of them forces and events that have been willed by government action, but also by forces that are beyond what it is that governments can do. For instance, the economic growth in Mexico is something that has been built on a very solid macroeconomic picture. It was forced upon Mexico, both by Mexico and the international community back in the early 1990s, middle 1990s, but now the macroeconomic standing of the Mexican economy is the envy of the world, certainly the envy of most advanced industrial societies, both in the United States, but also, of course, in Europe. The bilateral economic relationship, we've heard, is growing. This is a dramatic growth. And what we sometimes don't pay attention to, because sometimes bilateral economic relationships are very uneven. Take the United States and China, for instance. In this case, the fact that about 45, 47%, whatever it is that the $216 billion out of almost $500 billion comes to, about 45%, this is an extremely important, you know, takeaway, you know, as one looks at the relationship. The fact that products produced in Mexico have up to 40% U.S. content, this is exactly the opposite of the, what do we call it, Ross Perot, the giant sucking sound of sort of job losses and all this other stuff. Unfortunately, we don't always learn all the lessons that we need to learn because we don't follow an issue as closely as we have to follow it here at the Migration Policy Institute, of course, or Mexican officials have to follow it. And, of course, something else that we forget is that part of the, as the ambassador mentioned, the fact that total net total immigration, legal and illegal, okay, from Mexico is at or near zero, it's not only because of these economic forces, but there have been enormous and continuous social investments that have been made by the Mexican government over the last decade, decade and a half, and the current government is not only intending to continue and push the envelope further in that, but it's already doing so. So there is a confluence of different kinds of forces that contribute to this, and they create an opportunity for a bilateral relationship that is already very close, that is already very mature, even if we do not always understand how strong and how mature it is. So if you would like to say something or, you know, respond to a couple of things, please do, and then I will open the floor to comments. We will have about 30, 35 minutes for comments from the floor and questions.
Thank you very much. I would just say that I'm really, I mean, your comments were also a way of opening perspectives and reminding ourselves of how far things have gone. But just taking the comment on this discussion that was in the floor during the NAFTA debate on demographics and economic trends that would actually be as evolving towards where they are today. Just to briefly state something on the demographic evolution of Mexico. I have been always, in terms of my analytical approach to the world, very much hooked into demographics. And, well, I am 55 years old, so I come from a family of 9 siblings.
Okay.
That's normal. In 1960, the median fertility rate for Mexican women, my mom, was 7.2 children. Today is 2.2, so just above replacement. It actually came down from the year 2000, in which was 2.67 to 2.27 in 2012. In cities as Mexico City, Guadalajara, Monterrey, Querétaro, the rate is 1.8, so below replacement. That's not necessarily good. The U.S. Fertility rate is just level with replacement. It's 2.06. Mm-hmm. Replacement is always 2.1 because there are slightly more boys than girls born, but this is...
And since we don't split babies, you know, into 0.1 or whatever, 21 out of 100.
And but of course, it has changed dramatically. And of course, Mexico will not produce, in terms of growth, enough human beings in the long run, even to meet our own needs. And we will have to import people. That is already happening because we are absorbing Central American migrants into, for instance, manufacturing corridor in central Mexico and also the crop recollection in the north east coast, northwest coast. This is already there. But of course, we all see China as the driving force of the world. And I was looking this morning with Juan Carlos to the numbers in China, and of course, China will grow more than any other country in the world in the next 20 years. They have 1.3 billion people, but their fertility rate is 1.55. And the gender distribution of newborns is 113 boys per 100 girls. And the normal distribution is 106 boys per 100 girls. The issue is that, in this sense, China's population will shrink, for sure. And the country which has the best demographic profile in the OECD is the US. And I have always admired this country very much for many reasons. But the US has an unsurpassed ability to innovate, and then embody innovation into manufacturing and services as effectively as no one else. You have labor mobility, labor flexibility, better than anyone else. You have a very deep financial penetration and the ability to move resources from one sector of the economy to another sector of the economy without destroying the infrastructure. You have a rule of law, which is, we know what that means. This is very important. And you have the best demographic profile, because you will grow demographically more than Mexico from 2045 or so on. And this is because you have actually maintained a relatively healthy demographic dynamic, and also because the balance between population, geography, resources is gifted. Median age, and of course, how the population is distributed in the territory and how this matches resources. India, for instance, is only 50% larger than Mexico geographically. You have 3 million square kilometers, but you have 1.2 billion people, 650 million below the extreme poverty line. So in terms of balance between people, geography, resources, it's challenging. China does not have that problem, but the demographic dynamics do not look very nice. Ours is quite good. We have median age of 28, yours is 37, China is 34. In the long run, you look quite well. And this is because you embraced immigration, not only from Mexico, but from Mexico and other countries. And actually, your demographic performance looking forward is looking much better, precisely because you have a culture and a social dynamic that can actually embrace immigration and integrate immigration more effectively than anyone else in the world. Coming from Europe, they have tremendous cultural problems in this sense, and you are a country of immigrants, and this is what really has driven the greatness of this country, because migrants, as they, of course, the numbers show in terms of the contribution to the economy, they don't have other choice but to innovate, but to take risks, but to be entrepreneurs, actually create wealth and opportunities for themselves and their families. And this is, to my view, what makes this country so great. So I'm very happy to be the Mexican ambassador today, time in which Mexico is doing well, and I would see the forecast or what we can expect from the U.S. looks quite well. Even if it is very difficult for Mexicans to believe this in Mexico, and it's very difficult for Americans to believe this in the U.S., but this looks good. And as the future is ours, as we are very much integrated, we have no choice but to thrive together.
Thank you. This is, again, a very thoughtful and a lesson in comparisons. I'm reminded that China is going to be the only country in the history of the world up to now that will not enjoy what Mexico enjoyed, which was a long, almost leisurely demographic transition, which allows countries to get a dividend out of it, because the demographic transition of China is going to be reduced to at best 2 decades or a decade and a half. Very important point. So we'll now open it up to comments and questions from the floor. I see a hand over there. I see you.
My name is Jose Diaz Briseño, and I work for Mundo Fox and New Spanish TV Network. My question goes to the topic that the ambassador was talking at the very end. There are reports that there are going to be at least two new work visa programs under the new immigration bargain. Considering the changing dynamics of Mexican immigration to the U.S., do you expect that Mexico will receive the largest share of visas under both programs, one for agricultural workers, one for low-skilled workers? Or do you expect, immigration coming in the coming years from other countries in the world? I would appreciate if Mr. Medina Mora could address the question in quick Spanish. That'd be nice. Thank you.
Salvador, and then Doris?
I don't know.
I mean, we don't know.
I don't know either, but
I mean, we can speculate.
We can speculate very, very knowledgeably. So, I do not know whether the U.S. Congress, at the end of the day, will decide to give a special preference to people from the region for some of these new visas. But the default option of the way that the system works now and has always worked, since it is employer-driven, it is going to be based on relationships, often pre-existing relationships, that employers have with workers. That suggests to me that, you know, the majority of this, particularly for the temporary visas, and the temporary visas, you know, at the, let's say, the bottom half, because at the half and above, although the system is employer-driven and Mexico has become a player in these visas in the last decade, those visas will go to everybody around the world. So in these new visa systems, as we understand them now, there is no legislation that has been proposed, folks, okay, are going to go disproportionately, I think, to Mexico and others from the immediate region, the triangle, the northern triangle of Central America.
And you just add the...
In Spanish.
In Spanish. Solo agregaría que... lo que puede esperarse es que el sistema de visas será no discriminatorio en términos de origen nacional, pero si son trabajadores temporales, pues la habilidad de estos trabajadores de ir y regresar a sus lugares de origen jugará un papel importante en quienes pueden participar en programas, no porque no haya demanda potencial teórica en otros lugares del mundo, pero si son trabajadores temporales, en el sentido de que solamente podrán emplearse por un periodo determinado, la habilidad de regresar a sus lugares de origen a un costo relativamente bajo, naturalmente definirá la proporción de estos trabajadores que vendrán de la región inmediata, como lo ha señalado Dimitri en México y el Triángulo del Norte en Centroamérica.
Thank you. I have a hand in the first row, then in the second row, and let me know and I'll put thank you.
Thanks. I'm David Harrison. I'm a reporter for Congressional Quarterly here in D.C. I wanted to know, you probably heard about this new W visa program that the Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO struck that would cap the number of lower-skilled new guest workers at 200,000 a year as a maximum. Given the economic and demographic changes you've talked about in Mexico and the U.S., do you think that's going to be enough, or do you think that'll lead to we'll still have more sort of undocumented immigrants coming in despite these new visas?
So thank you for the question. The 200, at least as we understand it, you know, from reporting by people like you, the 200,000 number is going to be a maximum number, but it will start in stages, starting with 20,000, you know, starting with a small number. You must understand, we all understand it, in fact, that any openings in terms of these future workers will have to happen extremely carefully. This is a new area for the United States. The United States visas have concentrated either at the bottom end, and these are temporary, or at the high end, and these are temporary but green card earning visas. There are very few provisions, and often they're very difficult to do, in the middle occupations, for instance, steel trades. And this is sort of a terra incognita for the U.S. Congress and for everybody else. But I think it reflects a certain appreciation on the part of the people who are making these negotiations and will be proposing things, that in the future, workers will be needed all across the jobs continuum. And saying today
how many workers he will need in X or Y or Z 3 years from now is silly. So no one is going to do that. So they're going to start with, you know, small numbers. And I suspect today's jobs report, which I'm sure that at least reporters here have looked at, I have a copy of it here, the country added 88,000 jobs, which is less than half of the average for the last 2 months, and a third for the last 12 months, and a third of what it is that we added last year, will strengthen the hand of the people who are saying, what, bring in new foreign workers, you know, we're still having 22 million people who are either unemployed, underemployed, or outside of the labor force. So this is going to constantly be playing into the conversation, perhaps argument, about immigration reform. But it is imperative, we think here, you know, and I, you know, that includes Doris, the Institute thinks it is imperative that we create a framework that has an orderly way of allowing that number to fluctuate with economic conditions, because I can't tell you what's going to happen in 2015. Please, if you know, let me know. I'll try to do something with it. Thank you. Yes.
I'm Peggy Ochowski. I'm the congressional correspondent with the Hispanic Outlook, and I've been covering the immigration issues for almost a decade now. And it seems to me one of the biggest changes, I was so interested in your six principles, Doris, but that enforcement now doesn't only mean border enforcement, but it means internal enforcement. Since the development of ICE, which I think is one of the most significant developments in immigration management that we've had, we are now looking at internal enforcement, mainly of workers, and the E-Verify is probably the biggest change of it. But what I'm wondering is, as we increase internal enforcement, we have to talk about the D word, which is deportation. And it seems like suddenly deportation has become a crime against humanity. It's something of which we don't do. And yet, of course, it is an enforcement measure. So could you talk a little bit about deportation? And I'm curious from the ambassador how an impact of deportation, especially, say, of gang members. I think there's more problem in El Salvador, but how countries such as Mexico are dealing with, would deal with increased deportations.
Well, it is, exactly right or accurate that the interior enforcement has become a bigger and bigger factor. It was not a very big factor in the 1990s during the period of time that I was describing in terms of the border buildup. It's more a function of post 9/11 funding, but it is also an outgrowth of the 1996 laws and the changes in the 1996 laws that created mandatory detention and vastly expanded the list of crimes that subject a person to deportation. Now, you probably wouldn't be seeing quite as much deportation based on those 1996 laws if 9/11 hadn't happened, because the agency's capabilities and the creation of the Department of Homeland Security have made it possible to use those laws really to the fullest. But I think it is also fair to say that if you look back, you know, as we did in this enforcement report that we put out in early January, if you look back at the spending and at the consensus, the political consensus through appropriations that the Congress has had throughout this period, there have been two points of consensus and heavy funding. One is the border and border enforcement. The other is deportations and removals. So the scaling up of those two aspects of immigration enforcement have been consistently steady from the mid-1990s on, and as I said, they have been sustained by both parties, whether they were in the executive branch or in charge in the legislative branch. That is basically what we have done in the immigration policy arena in this whole period of time that we have not had broader reform to, I think most of us would argue, rationalize the overall system. What we've done is funded enforcement.
There, and then Ted.
Hi, thank you. I'm Jean Boucher. I'm at George Mason University in the sociology department. I appreciate the vastness, I guess, of this discussion. There's a lot here we're trying to juggle, and there's a lot of forces here beyond our control. I'm going to direct some comments to you, Doris. I spent some time as an activist in Arizona as a humanitarian in the desert, and I've not seen the government trying to help save lives. So your sixth point, I think, contradicts pretty much with the idea of deterrence. So one of the ideas of deterrence was to deter people from these main metropolitan areas and people are crossing through the desert. So as an example, so I was in Nogales, Mexico, working with people being deported, and a woman came up to me. She had her five-year-old daughter with her. She goes, "I can't find my husband." So she was apprehended in the desert. They were separated from each other. She gets deported to Nogales. He gets sent who knows where. This happens continually. To this day, it is still happening. Humanitarians in the desert trying to save lives are fighting against the government to put water in the desert. So I'd just like to tweak that little point of yours there. That's all. Thanks.
You're talking about more recent events, in the 2000s, when Arizona in particular, as you've described, you know, really became the sort of ground zero of all of this in terms of the overall border strategy. I'm talking about the 1990s when the foundations for all of this were laid. But I would say that, on the humanitarian front and on the desert issues in Arizona and so forth, I think that has been clearly the most difficult for all parties for all the reasons that you describe. And a lot of it is that it is absolutely terrain that is vast and it's inhospitable and it's pretty impossible. But what I do know is that if border safety had not explicitly become part of the Border Patrol's mission, even if there hasn't been cooperation with humanitarian groups, what there is when you look at the overall numbers is huge numbers of Border Patrol agents that are formally trained as EMTs, vehicles all outfitted with emergency equipment, with IV lines, ability to use them, airplanes, increasing use of air cover and use of air cover resources in places that are not the highest crossing but that are the most dangerous in order to try to spot people that are in distress, a whole set of operational techniques and tactics along with emergency response capabilities that simply didn't exist earlier. Now, could they be used more fully? Absolutely. But I'm not even defending what is or is not being done. What I do think the example that you're making demonstrates is how at the end of the day, the Border Patrol has been asked to deal with symptoms of a much larger dysfunction that we simply have not been able to solve politically. And at a certain point, there is only so much that law enforcement can do. And it can't ultimately resolve, in all cases, those are perverse circumstances where the law enforcement job and what it is told is its mission is one thing, and the humanitarian reality is another. And until there's a broader change in the overall paradigm, that tension is going to not be satisfying to anybody.
The ambassador has a comment, and the last both questions, and then.
Yes, of course, the issue of repatriation, as we call it can be either removal or deportation from the process it goes through, is a major concern for us, and it's a major bilateral concern, because it is actually throwing people to the border in this, at the port point of entry or the closest point of entry, or in a more concerning way, lateral, in a totally different geographical area in which they enter the country. It's no good for the migrants, it's not good for the communities receiving the migrants. It's actually not good for the process from the U.S. perspective, because actually builds stress in the families. It actually gives these people the incentive. The safest way to actually get out of that is come in again. This is not a good idea. So we have actually developed a pilot program of interior repatriation, which is actually people flown to Mexico City or other areas in Mexico, and we're about to hopefully get this established in a more larger scale, in which we have information about the people, and of course we can assist them go back to their communities of origin, and we can give them at least basic support in terms of food and clothing and shelter, in order to help them adjust to this very stressful circumstance of having been deported. And of course, in what you mentioned of gangs or people with a criminal record, this is difficult to actually deal with, because as Doris was mentioning, the list of behaviors that were criminalized because of the 2001 attacks here increased dramatically. So you have to distinguish people who are actually involved in crimes which are actually harming other people, and people who have been subject to criminal procedures because they actually, in a way, manipulated the documentation from which they could stay here. And that can eventually become a crime, and they can be processed because of that, but that's different sort of issues. So if we get the information, it's much easier for us to actually, once in Mexico, handle this. What we do not want is suddenly people just thrown into the border. This is a very bad idea for all parties involved, including, of course, Mexico, the U.S., the migrants, the communities that receive these people. So I certainly look forward to have a more comprehensive program from this very successful pilot one that we had the second half of last year to interior repatriation established in a more orderly manner. We have to do this in a, of course, orderly and safe manner for all parties involved.
I will take two more questions. I have Ted Alden there, and of course, and then we'll give an opportunity to our speakers to do some remarks, and then I'll say a couple of words, and then we'll let you go.
Ted Alden from the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks. If you look at the demographics that you've described, and certainly the economics currently, assuming it continues, Mexico is likely to become less important as a source country for illegal migration and more important as a transit country for people transiting through from Central America. What does that mean for policies going forward, both for enforcement on the U.S. side and for Mexico's role in trying to aid the United States in dealing with this issue?
That's a million-dollar question, Ted. I'm glad you asked it.
No, Mexico has not ever been, but it's not certainly from structural considerations in the business of exporting people. Certainly we will, as the growth perspective looks towards the future, we will be needing our own people, and we will face difficult circumstances from, 25 years from today. So the idea is, of course, to foster economic growth and foster opportunities in Mexico. This is, and of course, the demographic dynamics are showing that Mexico will not be a major source of migrants. We have oversupply of the first 3 years of elementary school already, more spaces than kids. The new entrance into the labor force peaked in 2007, and we have a smaller number each year. And then you just see the trends, and the the numbers in major urban areas are concerning because they are below replacement rate. But I think that we will essentially remain in these levels, and we can foresee that Mexico will not be a major source. Then you have the Northern Triangle, Central America. Central America is 42 million people. Their median age, ours is 28. Theirs is just above 26. But the three countries in the northern part of Central America have been a source of migrants. But still, if you add them all together, they might be 20 million people. So, I mean, the stock from which you can expect migration is not going to be there. And the trends in terms of fertility rate drop is there. And as it is in the world, because the world fertility rate in 1960 was 4.89. Today, the world fertility rate is 2.36. So the issue is where countries that can actually benefit from migrants from elsewhere will get their migrants. I mean, certainly not from the hemisphere. That can I assure you. Asia's fertility rates are dropping even faster than ours. As you can, I mean, China is an example, but other countries are dropping also very fast. So the issue is, and of course, economic growth will be, in a way, much less based on new jobs. This is, you have seen GDP growth without job creation. But there are certain activities that are not possible to get any growth without getting actually workers. I mean, agriculture, you can mechanize, of course, corn and wheat and soy, but you cannot mechanize fruit and vegetables recollection. At least you can only do that to a certain extent. Construction is also an issue. So I don't have the answer, but certainly Mexico will not be a major source of migrants into the U.S. Regardless of politics, regardless of public policy, this is demographics. We won't have the supply.
Thank you. This is a very thoughtful reply. Let me just put it in very direct, simple English. The future of Mexico is primarily as an immigration country, not as an emigration country, just as the future of Turkey, of Indonesia. In other words, we have to really think about sort of immigration globally and totally differently. You know, we're playing with the hymnal and the book from 20 years ago. And if we don't modernize our own thinking, how are we going to modernize our own policies? You will have the last question. How are you?
My name is Gregorio Veras. I'm correspondent for Televisa News Network. It is obvious that even resolving the situation of 11 million of undocumented people here in the U.S., the American economy is going to need more labor force from Mexico. In case of these guest worker programs, is it possible to learn from the past experiences and maybe provide them better conditions if they come for a certain time? And in the second hand, in regards with what Ambassador Medina Mora have mentioned, is it possible that once the immigration problem is solved in the U.S., new migrants, better skilled migrants from Mexico can have opportunities in the U.S.? Maybe it will change the flu?
No, you don't. We understand the question. It's a very important question. Ambassador, are you going to say anything on this?
I think that the trend of migration globally is going to be totally different than how it was in the past, and will be, to my view, increasingly much more related to skilled people moving around, and this is already a fact in the financial sector, for instance, services business. If you go to London, you find people from all around the globe. If you go to New York, you find people from all around the globe, and these people are quite skilled. This is nothing to do with national origin. This has nothing to do with actually pressures in the country of origin, or this is actually market-based. And in that sense, I think that economic growth in terms of, as it relates with technology, innovation, services, more sophisticated value-added economy moving up in the value-added layers in manufacturing will mean migration in reduced numbers, but in higher skills from wherever they come, certainly Mexico, Central America, India, Germany, the UK, you name it.
We'll consider this the last word from the ambassador.
Yep.
Doris?
That's a good last word.
That's a good last word. thank you very much for having joined us. I should tell you that in the next month or so, the Migration Policy Institute will be releasing the report of its Regional Migration Study Group, which incidentally will be addressing all of these issues that you have asked questions on, including questions that you didn't formulate and ask us. Thank you very much.
For more information on the Migration Policy Institute's Regional Migration Study Group, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/regionalstudygroup.